Welcome to the About, From, and With podcast, a podcast showcasing speech-language pathologists' journeys to finding their passion and purpose in the field. I'm your host, Dr. Danica Pfeiffer. In each episode, we'll learn about, from, and with SLP clinicians and researchers as they share their experiences, advice, and expertise. Hello, and thanks for tuning in for another episode of About, From, and With. If you haven't already, be sure to follow the podcast so you'll be notified of new episodes when they come out. You can also follow me in the podcast on Instagram at danicapfeiffer.slp or on Twitter at aboutfrom_with. In this episode, I'll be discussing the process of applying for clinical educator positions with Dr. Cherie Harbick. Dr. Harbick is a speech-language pathologist and clinical educator at James Madison University. Her clinical background informs her research conducted through the Infant and Toddler Language Lab and the James Madison University Speech-Language Clinic. Her current research involves working with families and caregivers to support the communication development of 6 through 12-month-old infants and developing clinical experiences in early intervention for graduate clinicians in communication sciences and disorders. Cherie lives in the Shenandoah Valley with her husband Andy and is the mother of 3 young adult sons. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Cherie, who discusses how she made her dissertation study into a full-time position as a clinical educator. Hi, Cherie. Thanks so much for being here with me today on the podcast.
Hi, Danica. It is such an honor just to be asked to participate with you. I could talk to you for a long time.
Well, I always love having my JMU folks on the podcast, so I know this will be a fun one. All right. Well, let's jump in and start off with a little bit about you before you started your academic journey. Tell us a little bit about who you are and where you came from.
I grew up in primarily Northern Virginia. So I grew up in the town of Reston. I wanted to be girl detective. So Nancy Drew was like a big part of my life. Harriet the Spy. I was an avid reader. And so I read everything I could get my hands on, especially mysteries. And as I think about it, I realized like as a kid, I was an information collector and organizer. Mm-hmm. Like I literally, besides doing detective and spy related things in my backyard, I tried to start libraries of information and this was all like pre-internet. So, you know, libraries were very important places then.
How did you end up deciding where to go to college and what to study?
Yeah. So, and maybe this would be good for your guests to know, I'm older than your traditional, you know, starting out academic. So this is very much what I think of as my second half of my career as an SLP. So I went to JMU, where I am right now, in the 90s. I actually graduated with my undergrad in 96 and my master's degree a year and a half later in 97. I graduated early, which doesn't happen really anymore. But I had decided in high school, I actually came to JMU because of speech language pathology or audiology. I was really open to audiology at the time too, CSD. I kind of discovered it in 11th grade. Up until then, if you had asked me what I wanted to be, I would tell you that I was going to be a writer. And I was the editor of our literary and art magazine. I took creative writing 3 times in high school.
Wow.
All those mysteries. I wanted to write Nancy Drew books. but I also became aware as I took, you know, classes and things that like science was something I loved as well. So sort of figuring out like I'm a writer and a scientist, I should probably be both. I actually discovered doing some career project, speech language pathology, when I instinctively knew that this sort of marriage of science and communication would work really well for me. I gave up on my longtime plan, much to my mother's disappointment, of going to William & Mary, which I had gotten into, but they didn't have an undergraduate program in CSD at the time. They still don't. And so I felt like coming to JMU as part of what was then the honors program was also a good fit for me. And so I came to JMU and did my undergrad work here and my master's work here. And as an undergrad, I did an undergraduate honors thesis with Brenda Seal. She was a little younger than I am now and had just finished her PhD and was just a fabulous mentor to me. I kind of got that first experience in research and I really took to the statistics part of it.
Okay.
And which matched the sort of science math kind of things that I also gravitated towards. So yeah, so I actually, one of the reasons I wanted to stay for grad school was because I could extend that line of research from undergrad. And then I was pretty hooked. By then I was like, I knew I wanted to do a PhD.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. That's so neat. Yeah, it really does sound like the perfect combination of things to prepare you well for pursuing a PhD. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned that this was kind of the second half of your career. So what did you do after grad school?
Yeah. So probably you're all wondering, like, why didn't she go right on and get her PhD? And well, because life.
Yes.
as you all know, life happens. And so I had gotten married. And of course, I married a man that was very intelligent and very high performing as well. And so some of, you know, there's just a lot of give and take that has to happen, and different people's careers need to take precedence at different points. And sort of, we decided from a young age that we wanted to do life together. And so that's sort of what it took for us to do that. So in the late 90s, my husband got recruited to this company no one had ever heard of, Amazon.com. And right. And we made the really hard choice to leave Virginia. And my first job, I worked in Fairfax County Schools and moved to Seattle to work for this startup.
Wow.
And yeah. And in retrospect, that was like 100% the thing we should have done. But it made some of my academic aspirations take a back seat. As we focused on that, so we started a family. We had two kids while we were there. But all through it, I was able to keep like some connection to research.
Okay, but you were working clinically throughout this whole time.
Yeah, not as much during that time.
Okay,
but my clinical work really happened when we came back to Virginia.
Okay,
so I did a lot of I did a lot of full-time mothering.
Yes.
Of little people. Yes. In Seattle.
Very important.
And research work tasks.
Okay.
So I was hired on a few grants. I did some data stuff through, you know, connections that I had made in grad school.
That's like awesome. That.
But I still wasn't even as clinical as I became later. So that's
awesome.
Good.
I'm glad you shared that, because I think for a lot of people, these journeys are not linear and things happen along the way, and that's totally okay.
And I want people to know that, like, I've dealt with like some guilt and shame at having like come so far and having, you know, I got scholarships and people told me all the time about all this promise that I was demonstrating. And then it looked like I was just ending it all, you know, mm-hmm. to stay at home with my kids. And I knew that that wasn't the full story yet.
Right.
But, you know, other people didn't necessarily understand that. And so I would feel bad, you know, talking to professors or people from my past about what I was doing. And I think it's important for people to realize that, like, one of the great things about this profession is you can do that. I really remember thinking of those like 5 years in Seattle as my retirement. Like, these are my retirement years, because I knew on the other end, I would probably not be doing the typical retirement things. And I think it's turning out that way. So I wouldn't do it differently, but it was hard. It was very hard to do because you don't know the future. If I'd known for sure, you know, what I would be doing right now, it would have been a lot easier, but you don't know.
You don't know. No. And life, it has its professional elements. We have our personal elements, and
it does.
Yeah. And I think there's no right path and there's no right way to get there. So I'm glad that you shared that. So you did eventually come back and you just recently completed your PhD. Congratulations.
I did. Thank you.
It's very, very exciting. And when did you start thinking about your next steps after your PhD during that time?
Again, like I think having had the experiences in life that I've had where things fell into place. So like, I guess a really crucial part of my journey to the PhD that I left out was that we moved back to Virginia. I worked in private practice for a long time. My third son was born with a genetic disorder and lots of needs. And for years I said that he was my PhD, right? Because I gave up on it at that point. I was like, there's no way this is going to happen. I don't see how. But as he got older and things started evening out for him and the support that he needed, and my husband was able to kind of shift his functioning, it suddenly became my turn to be able to do this. And I was back at JMU again, not something that I planned, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with like some serious mentorship. I already mentioned Brenda Seal, and I can't imagine a mentor more driven and purposeful than she has been in my life. She just never let go of me, right? She knew I was doing the thing at each point along the way that I needed to do. She trusted my judgment, but she was also on the lookout for when things might change for me. And honestly, I don't know if I would have had sort of the courage to continue towards a PhD even halfway through a clinical career if it hadn't been, you know, some heart deep conversations with her. And specifically, we went out to lunch one day and I was filling her in on my clinical practice and things I liked, the things that I wished that I could do more of. And she just really honed in on this sort of liminal space in life for me and said, well, I don't tell you this lightly, and I might not have ever told you, but your PhD is on my bucket list.
She was determined.
Yes. And I was like, wow, my PhD is on Brenda's bucket list. But she also identified that like, this might be the time, Cherie. This might be the time to do it. And she was actually also connected to a research team at JMU in the infant toddler language lab that is run by Rory DePaulis. And she and Susan Ingram and Charlotte McQuilkin were all like working on several research projects related to intervening really early in the life of an infant and family for language development. And she kind of intuited that this might be a really great fit, that they needed a PhD student to do some of the things they had envisioned and that I was ready and my life was at a place where I could do it.
Had you had those thoughts that this was a good time, or was this kind of all news to you?
I think that I have always been looking for the good time. Okay. I don't think I ever fully gave up on it. And I will share too that I was part-time as a PhD student, which is a little different. I paid for my own tuition, but what that gave me was flexibility on the other end, like to do the other things that I really was passionate about or needed time to do.
That's good for people to know, because most PhD programs are funded if you are able to go full-time.
Yes. And I, at the outset, by the end, like my advisor ended up being Rory DePaulis, and he said that I was the most full-time, part-time student he's ever met, which is very in character, but it was really important for me to have a lot of control over my time and obligations because other people depended on me at home.
Right. And what a great way to get through the PhD program, but also be present for your family. I think there's probably a lot of others that are listening to this that maybe have thought about the PhD, but it might seem impossible. Yeah. And you found a way to make it all work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like to share just the non-traditional stories because I don't fit the what you might think is traditional. Maybe there isn't traditional.
I don't think there is anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's great to share all of the different paths. Absolutely. Yeah. So you just recently finished up your program and you had to start thinking about what was going to be next. So how, what was important to you in thinking about your next steps once you finally were wrapping up the PhD?
Yeah, well, I really in the last year and a half of the PhD program was when you really need to start thinking about what is coming next and what do you want. And when I started, I really didn't have an expectation what would come after it. I just knew that this program itself was going to give me a lot of the tools that I had been wanting a long time in terms of being not just a great consumer of research, but somebody who can contribute to the research base. And that is so motivating to me. And so I knew that that was my motivation for doing it. And I had to kind of come up at the beginning with some personal whys to help me like fully understand why I'm going in the direction. Why am I investing in myself in this way? What are the potential outcomes? And I had to be okay with, if the outcome is that I have a PhD and I go back to private practice, that's valid. That is absolutely 100% valid. You can do that. I was not going to live with a guilt feeling again, like I felt like I did after my graduate school and then, you know, some stay-at-home mom time. And so I did not want to do that to myself again. And I think age and maturity helps me with that.
Yeah, that's so smart to do that up front, to come up with those whys up front, because I think once you get going and you hear what everyone else is doing, you can get off track and you lose the why, you lose your values, you lose your priorities. So I think that's so smart.
Yeah, that was really important part of it. And I could share those whys with the very close mentors that I had so that they understood, you know, they have a lot of, your committee has a lot of influence over really the direction that you go next and what they're encouraging you to do and what advice they might be giving you and things like that, so that they know that you're pretty self-defined in a certain direction. Mm-hmm. It's important for them to know that. They had a good idea too, of me being sort of open to multiple possibilities at the end of a PhD program. Like the PhD program was very much like a journey for me that was very personal and meaningful. And it wasn't just a means to an end. I think what became a thing though was my research. I got really attached to it. It feels like my fourth child.
Yeah, right. You become so invested.
Yeah, I have the same sense of like shepherding, need to shepherd guide this line of research. And that, and it seems like I could keep doing it. That was what I sort of led with for sort of what comes next phase is what comes next is the thing that will allow me to continue with this line of research that I have started and that I see great potential for and that there's so much more to do of.
And your research that you did during your dissertation was really clinically focused, really clinical training focused. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? Because I think that will help connect the pieces here.
Yeah, I think it will. So I developed a program. The nugget of it was the idea of this committee that sort of this research group that sort of recruited me to come be their PhD student to help define this idea that they had. And the idea was to provide early support to parents with babies for communication development and support graduate students in having experiences with parent coaching and young infants at the same time. And so I developed something that we call the FIRST program. It means facilitating infant responsiveness to stimulate talking. But what it does is it takes families with babies 6 to 12 months old and brings them to campus and pairs them with two graduate students. And we work in large groups together, like the families with the babies and the clinicians all together. Do sort of a large group, sort of this is our topic for the day kind of thing that I lead or another clinical educator could lead. And then they break out into smaller groups and the graduate students do coaching in how to actually apply the things that we just learned about in terms of supporting language development with their specific infant. I measured baby things, I measured caregiver things, I measured student things, really compelling results. And it seemed like a program that was worth doing. It was good for our community. It's good for babies, and it is good for graduate clinicians to have these experiences.
Yes, absolutely. I can see how you would become really invested in something like that and seeing how successful it was in getting off the ground. And so now you had this amazing experience with your mentors, your advisors, with the community members, with your graduate students. And so how did that factor into your decision of what to do after the PhD?
I realized that clinical education, which this research was as much about providing clinical education experiences for new graduate students as it was services to babies and families, that was really a big part of my new why. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, now you're somebody equipped with the skills that a PhD has, right? I've got teaching and scholarship, and I understand the academic world in a way I didn't before. Now what's the next why? Like, how do you take your years in the clinic and your privilege you've had of gaining this additional degree? What do I do with it? And to me, the clinical education position that I was looking for again happened at the same time that I needed it at JMU.
Which is wonderful.
It is wonderful and also weird and not typical at all. And so I just want to caution people that this doesn't normally happen. And I couldn't have planned it ever.
So there was an opening in the department that you were doing your PhD in that just popped up right at the right time.
Exactly the right time.
Tell us what the position is and what it means to be a clinical educator. Some might not be familiar with that term.
The way that mine is structured, but I think most clinical educator positions probably are, is it's not, my particular one is non-tenure track. Others might be. I think that sort of could be either way. And it might even be something you could potentially negotiate. The application process was identical to what you would do for a tenure track faculty position, at least for me it was. But it's defined as 75% teaching. My actual title is lecturer.
Okay.
And that's how it fits sort of within the system that JMU uses for clinical instructional faculty, which is what I am. And so 75% of my time is spent teaching, which means I'll teach one class a semester. I'll run a few diagnostic teams of graduate students within our speech language clinic. And then I'll supervise sessions with graduate students in our clinic. The other 25% of my time is devoted to research and service. And this position was described as appropriate for PhD level.
Okay.
And that research was encouraged as part of it was a big draw. And that's something you always see. So that would be something to look at. Mm-hmm. Is research not just permitted,
right,
but actively encouraged, right?
Right. So, and supported.
And supported, yeah. And like, we have seen at JMU that the FIRST program has made a big impact on our clinical services, and we're wanting to start like a specialty clinic essentially that will be the FIRST program. So now my research becomes part of my job, and the research components can fit into the research part, but then the educational components are the teaching part.
Wow, so that seems like a really perfect fit.
Yeah.
Seems like things just fell into place.
They did, and I feel really, really fortunate to have had that.
For non-tenure track, those are usually contract positions where your contract comes up and you have to re-sign, and that could be every year, could be every 3 years, depending. Was that your experience with your non-tenure track position, that you have kind of a renewable contract over time?
Yes. Mine's annually renewable.
Okay.
However, I will say that given that the application process was really the same as the tenure track process and took a long time
Yes,
to do,
absolutely.
I would find it, I think that it would be really hard to let somebody go that
Yes.
went through all of that for, right?
Right. Not only have you invested all that time, but they have invested all that time
That's
in
a lot.
you as well and going through the interview
Yeah.
process. Absolutely. And there's more and more non-tenure track positions that are coming up in our field. And so I think we're going to see more and more, not only for clinical educator positions, but assistant professor positions as well. So I think this is something that we'll see more and more, and people are going to be having questions about. Can you talk to us a little bit about this application process that you just mentioned and what kinds of documents you had to submit?
Besides my CV, I had to have a few statements that I prepared ahead of time in writing. So I submitted a philosophy of teaching. I submitted information about like my research interests and activities beyond what is described in the CV. They just need to hear it more about that. And then the diversity, equity, and inclusion statement is pretty standard now, but new for a lot of people. So I would say that was actually one of the harder ones to write, just because I hadn't read many models of them, and but it was also really rewarding to put the time into that I did.
Okay, great. So those are, like you said, those are very similar to tenure track position documents that you might have to write. Do you feel like there was anything in particular that you were trying to highlight because this was a clinical educator position that might be a little bit different than things you would highlight for a tenure track assistant professor position?
What I really honed in on was the nature of my research being a clinical education initiative,
Yes.
and that this role fit me well and my research well for those specific reasons.
Yeah,
So,
but it really does sound like it was the perfect
yeah.
fit.
Yep, it was.
And how did you prepare for your interviews, and what were these interviews like?
Yeah, so the first interview was on Zoom
Okay.
with the search committee, and it lasted a little over an hour. And they had definitely like standard questions that I'm sure they asked every candidate. And I felt really prepared for most of them, just having gone through the application materials and, being in the last year of a PhD program. I feel like JMU does a very nice job preparing us for what's coming, in terms of the job market. I wasn't surprised by most of it. I think again, the diversity, equity, and inclusion type questions, I was ready for them, but I have very little experience with those types of questions. And so, I didn't feel unprepared, but I had those took a little more thought in the mint of how I was going to answer what I was asked. And I can't even remember totally what they asked me. It was something kind of generic. And I think that's what makes some of the DEI questions hard, is you have to figure out what you have learned or what you value or what progress you've made in terms of that type of learning and competency, and find your hook to match their question. And that's just not something any of us have had a lot of experience doing yet. So I actually found mine really in the inclusion and the diversity part of it, one being the parent of a child with intellectual disabilities. Inclusion means something different to me than if I hadn't lived with that. And then diversity and the nature of the FIRST program really is to include low-income families in our community. And there's so many languages and cultures, and helping first-year graduate students to navigate that when very often their culture is totally very different than what they're encountering.
Yeah, those sound like
So.
great things to share when you get asked those kinds of questions. It's figuring out what
Yeah.
experiences you've had and what you've learned and what how you want to keep learning and keep helping this department or wherever you're interviewing and helping them improve their diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in their university. So I think it can look really different person to person. And you're right. It takes a lot of reflection when you're going into writing these documents and answering these questions, because everyone's answer is probably going to look really different.
Yeah. And I think it would be fun to be on that committee asking these questions, because it would help it feel sometimes the DEI initiatives could be critiqued as performative or, a band-aid. And I think having them intentionally included and then promoting that personal reflection and small group discussion is huge.
Yes. I was just talking on another interview with someone who went on the job market this year, and she was talking about how sometimes we are asked to write these diversity statements and it's never brought up in the interview process at all. And there's no follow-up questions about it. And so it does feel a little bit performative, but it's nice that in your case, they did ask you about it and it was really a priority.
Yeah, they did. And honestly, because they asked that, I realized that it was really important to include some of my perspectives on that in the second interview talk that I gave.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that talk.
Yeah. So when they narrowed down the list of candidates, then we had our full day interview on campus. And it was a little weird for me. I'm very familiar with this campus and the people here.
Yes.
But it would be really important for somebody that was brand new to get a feel, would they like to be here or not? It's really well done, and it's a full day of talking to people. And I was asked to give a talk on what I saw as, I think it was clinical challenges, like challenges in clinical education, and how would I solve them?
Okay.
Kind of right?
What
and
a prompt.
So and so it was pretty wide open. I did enjoy working on that and doing that talk, and I was able to get, they scheduled me for the morning. So after I met with the academic unit head, the department head, then I went straight to giving the talk right off the bat. And that was to faculty and students. And I got great feedback from that, which felt nice. Somebody told me that she got teary-eyed during it. Actually, two people told me that.
Wow, you must have been so passionate about.
Yes, well, as a clinical educator, I'll tell you and everybody else secretly, no, everybody knows this, that I very much like to help people feel seen and understood. And so it's not a good semester if somebody doesn't cry around me. For a good reason, because they feel heard and seen and supported.
Yes.
And so to have some people say they even felt that way in a talk just felt like a lot of confirmation for me that this is what I should be doing.
Those are moments that are so hard to describe, but when they happen, especially when it's involving your next steps in your life or your professional career, when those moments happen and you feel like, oh, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be, it's just the greatest feeling.
It really is. It feels just right. And so my husband will jokingly tell people that Cherie makes people cry.
And you're proud of it.
Yes, but it's not for the reasons you might assume. I'm very proud of it. So,
that's amazing. Who else did you meet with during that day?
Yeah. So I spent time with the clinic director, and which was strange because she was also on my committee.
Okay.
And we knew each other really well. But, there were lots of things I didn't know, that my program did a good job of keeping me in the PhD world, even though I also did work as a clinical educator on a part-time basis. Here, there were a lot of internal things that I did not know, and that were good for me to get a feel for, if this is your job, these are the kinds of things you'll have to think about that we've never asked you to think about before.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really helpful. And good to know. And then I think I met with almost everybody on the faculty for 15 minutes each.
Okay.
They would come see me in a conference room, and I decided, since I was familiar with many of them, that like I was also interviewing as much as I was being interviewed. Mm-hmm. And so I actually had specific questions for them ahead of time that I wanted to know as it would relate to this potential position for me.
That's a great idea to prepare some questions ahead of time. I'm sure they were looking for that too, that you came prepared with some questions. So a lot of faculty, the clinical director, clinic director, and then the department head, anybody else?
Yeah, and then the students, a group of undergrad and graduate students took me out for lunch.
Nice.
And so I got to have sort of more informal discussions with them, but they had questions prepared also, and I had questions for them. So that was a really good time to do that. I think the student perspective is arguably one of the most important ones that you should consider before taking a position. And so, and they did a good job of providing me with multiple types of students to talk to. So I really did enjoy that part a lot. And getting some feedback from students about what is important to them from a clinical education standpoint specifically was really good.
Yeah,
and then we went out to dinner as a search committee at the end, and any additional questions that came up, and it was very, very thorough.
That's great. That's a very full day.
It was, yes.
Wow. Okay, so at the end of the day, how are you feeling about the position and the process, and were you feeling like that was the place to be?
Yeah. So I started my position this month, and you know, it's still the summer, and so things are getting reworked. We actually, JMU added 2 full-time clinical educator positions this summer. So I have a counterpart who I've just met.
How nice.
And so yeah, and we can already tell that we work very well together. There's some clinical education things that were already happening this summer, like a summer camp that we do. And she and I were intentionally paired together as like co-teachers in a classroom. And that was a really great way for she and I to get to know each other and our styles with students and clients. And we could tell that we were a great match.
That's awesome. That's so nice to be able to start with somebody else when you're coming into a position.
Yeah, it feels like having like a built-in partner to sort of learn things with and pool our knowledge. I have background knowledge that she doesn't have. She'll think to ask questions that I might just assume answers to, but they might not be the right answers.
Right.
So it's good.
Someone to bounce ideas off of. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Reflecting back on this whole process of interviewing for this position, did you face any challenges during that time along the way and hit any roadblocks along the way?
I think the process took longer than I was anticipating that it would. And that might have just been a JMU-specific thing. I'm not sure. I think in general it does just take longer, though, because departments want to make sure they have the right person.
Right.
There, and you want it to be the right fit as well. And so I think the length of it, you know, was longer than I expected, but I wouldn't really call that challenging, but it would have been if I had other clear paths. Like I did look at other opportunities, but then I quickly decided that I needed to stop looking at other opportunities because I was going to get really conflicted really fast.
Okay.
There were things that would have fit me nicely and would have fit into my life. And I would not necessarily, I'm not in the place where I wanted to move, but that wouldn't have been a barrier. Like there are positions out there that I could have done. It didn't have to be here. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to do that work just to know for myself,
because
it's so strange to do everything at JMU like I've done.
Right.
And so, but then I also need to stop that searching because I really was invested in continuing the first program that I've been working on for a few years. And that made what would be much easier to keep doing at JMU than anywhere else.
Did you ever come back to that list of whys that you talked about in the beginning when you were going through that process?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that that's something I will foster. I think even through retirement, got 15 years at least before I would retire But I just think at all of these inflection points, that's become a really powerful and helpful motivator for keeping me on track with what my values and desires and like needs are personally.
Yeah, I love that advice. I really didn't do that until I had been on the job market once and was going on it for a second time to find a position. And that's when I sat down and really spent time reflecting on what is it that really will make me feel fulfilled. And once I did that, everything became so much clearer. It was so easy to say, I'm applying to this, I'm not applying to that. So I really love that you talked about that too and how helpful it was for you. I think that's great advice. Before we end today, I just have some rapid fire questions that I ask all my guests. So the first one is, what is one resource that you couldn't live without?
I could not live. I just put it away. That's why I'm laughing. I have fully made the switch from paper things to digital things. And I've wanted to do that for years, but I couldn't find a way to do it. And the way I do it is I have an iPad now with a pen, and I use the Notability app, and I handwrite just like I've always wanted to. I used to have 100 million sticky notes everywhere and all kinds of systems. And now I have it all in one place.
Wonderful.
And I can just pop it in and out of my bag. It's really wonderful. It's redone the way that I function, quite honestly.
Awesome. Good for you.
Yep.
What has been a defining moment in your academic journey?
I can actually go to a single day. I think I'm really motivated by actually just helping people, right? And the first day I designed this first program, right? And it was going to be this 8-session thing. And I was really specifically looking for low-income moms and their babies to come. And I had a lot of community help to get them, find them. I mean, I had case managers, nurse practitioners, teachers, home visitors, like all helping me find these families. And I remember the first day that everyone was supposed to show up, and I had all these clinicians that were paired, but we never met, you know, all these things. It was so nerve-wracking as to like, is this going to work? This was so much effort. Is it going to work? And everybody but one family showed up, but then a woman called me in the morning English wasn't her first language, and she knew that it was the first day, and she thought she could just show up for it, and she wanted directions. And so I had her number, so I called her, and she came and filled it in, and it worked beautifully. And everything that I had planned not only worked, but it worked. Many things happened that I didn't plan that were beautiful and powerful, down to the mom who was a refugee from North Africa, and she carried her baby here, and the graduate students who, like, we were trying to figure out how to get her home because she didn't have a car. And it took like 5 or 6 people to figure out like the bus route, and that it was actually easier for her to just walk down the hill to her house, and the graduate students who were just like, I'm going to just walk with her and carry some stuff.
So nice.
Right? Mm-hmm. Just the way we all pulled together and the relationships that started. And I remember thinking after that first day, okay, this is going to work. And all that effort that we put into it is more than worth it, because really, really amazing things are happening.
That's awesome.
And that just made anytime I feel discouraged, or I just go back to the people and the students and the infants, and I realized that, like, if I don't even get great data out of this, it doesn't matter. Like, something important has happened.
Yes.
Meaningful in the lives of individual people. And that is endlessly motivating and encouraging to me.
Oh, that's like a goosebump story.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And now you get to keep doing this really important and meaningful work, which is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
What is one thing on your professional bucket list?
That is hilarious that that's one of your questions. Bucket list got me into this.
Now you have to update it.
I know. Now I have to update it. One of the great things about being a clinical educator PhD is that I can mentor students and I could be on people's committees and I can involve others in this work, in this really clinically relevant work. And so I would like to have a PhD student or to be involved at least in partnering with PhD students.
Yes, I think that would be a really meaningful experience. What has been your favorite part about your journey as a PhD student?
I have gotten to, it's the people. It's always about the people for me.
Yeah.
And to just to develop really deep relationships with other faculty members, with students who I'm just like a little piece of their professional journey. With parents in our community, with infants in our community, mm-hmm. just the relationships and how it all weaves together and kind of builds upon itself. It's really, that's my favorite part.
Awesome. And final question, how can people connect with you or learn more about you and your research?
Yeah. So I am active on Twitter. My handle is S Harbick. And email is always great. I love to get emails from people who are interested in what I'm doing. And I like to talk about how I got here. And I enjoy talking to people, especially who are wondering if it's possible, like what they are thinking, is this even possible? Mm-hmm. And just sharing from my own experience, that sort of advice. So, you know, people should feel free to email me.
Perfect.
If they want to talk some more, that's okay.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here and sharing your job search journey. And congratulations to you again. And I wish you much continued success.
Yay. Thanks, Danica. I really appreciate the time to share my story.
Thanks so much for tuning in for another episode of About From and With. I hope you enjoyed it. I encourage you to follow the podcast so you'll be notified of new episodes as they come out. And please consider leaving a rating or review as well. You can find the show notes and transcripts at aboutfromandwith.com and connect with me on Instagram at danicapiefer.slp or on Twitter at aboutfrom_with. Until next time, stay humble and kind.